When I grow up, I'm going to be a veterinarian?
It's awesome.
And I'm going to be what you said we need more of.
So you want to be a plumber-narian?
Do you think I can?
I think that if you work really hard, you can be anything.
Promise?
You bet I do.
When you promise your kids the world, we're here to help you keep it. Ohio's 529 plan is the best tax-free savings plan for future college or career training nationwide. Start now at collegeadvantage.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор Олиар.
I'm Greg Olear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. I'm still away. It's still a rerun, but I will be back next week for season 5. In the meantime, great show. The author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, is here. This was recorded over a year ago on January 4th, 2022. It's a great discussion. She's fantastic and terrifying. So have a listen. We'll be right back with Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Joe Rogan knows, he knows the cure. If Rona comes, here's what to do. When you have a bad cough and you want to get off, take Viagra, take Viagra. When you have loss of smell and you're horny as hell, take Viagra. Aching head, stuck in bed, seeing red, almost dead, and you're grouchy. Dough will rise, all the guys who take Pfizer's like the size of their Fauci. Fauci. If at Biden you see, when so sick you can't breathe, take Viagra. Mix your ventilation with some masturbation, it's the cure. When you're blue in the balls and blood oxygen falls like Niagara, your last dying breath as you stave off your death, take Viagra. Take Viagra.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, welcome to the Prevail podcast.
Glad to be speaking with you.
I've been wanting to have you on for a long time because your book is fantastic. Your book is called Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present.
And there's a lot of strongmen about now. So I want to talk to you about all kinds of stuff like that, the stuff that's in your book, Strongmen Past, Strongmen Present, and all that. But before we start, I want to find out more about you. Now, you're a professor of history and Italian studies at NYU, and you're known for the work on fascism and on dictators, right? So why did you choose this niche? What about it appeals to you?
Well, it's not too appealing. You end up like to write Strongmen, I had to immerse myself for 2 years in the heads of these awful people, both the leaders and their followers. But I actually got interested in the subject in a kind of roundabout way because I grew up in a beach town in Southern California, Pacific Palisades, where a lot of Germans, famous German exiles from Nazism had come to my town and Santa Monica and all around there. And you could see their traces. And like my high school math teacher was Arnold Schoenberg's son. And so I was very interested in like, what did it mean to have to flee from your country because a horrible dictator takes over? So I was interested in exile. And I write today a lot about exile, and I write in the book about exile. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then when I went to graduate school in history, I decided to work on Italy because it wasn't as researched as Nazi Germany. And I felt that there could be more original work to be done.
That's interesting because I think you, and you make this point in the book really strongly, no pun intended, that Mussolini really is the template for all this stuff. And it was very much Hitler's template. I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about The Great Dictator, the movie. And there's that great scene in it where, you know, Chaplin is basically Hitler, and the Italian guy is, I forget what the actor's name is, this big portly man, you know, physically much larger than him. And he's trying to make himself, Chaplin is, to make himself seem tough, but he's immediately overshadowed by the Italian as soon as he walks in the room, and there's like nothing he can do about it. And at least for a short period of time, that was the dynamic, or it seemed to be, between those two guys. Even though now looking back on it, I think if you pull people off the streets and asked, everybody would be like, oh, no, Hitler was the guy. Mussolini was kind of the.
Yeah. You know. And I wanted to tell this story because it was Mussolini. Not only he was the first one to do this, and Hitler idolized him. In fact, it's very they had a very ended up being very tormented relationship. But it started with Hitler bothering Mussolini constantly for his autograph, for pictures of himself. Because, you know, Mussolini started fascism in 1919, and 3 years later, he was prime minister. So it was meteoric rise. And then he's also more relevant for today because he was prime minister in a democracy for three years. And during that time, he laid down the template of how to destroy democracy. And then he had a crisis because he was going to be kicked out, perhaps, and forced to resign because there was a corruption scandal, also very 21st century. And then he declared dictatorship. But Hitler watched all of this, and Hitler hugely admired him and took notes on what he was doing. And Mussolini didn't want anything to do with Hitler because he thought he was a loser, because here's somebody who tried to have a putsch and it didn't work, and he went to jail. And then, of course, later the tables turned. But it's really from Mussolini that we get a lot of the personality cult and the attacks on the press and all of that. So I wanted to kind of restore the full story of how Hitler learned from Mussolini, because these guys learn from each other. And so the first learning experience was Hitler learning from Mussolini, not the other way around.
It's, you say, a war on the press. I mean, Mussolini literally went and destroyed the presses, right? It wasn't even calling out the editors. It was like, we're going to just make this stuff not work so that the newspapers can't be printed.
Well, and he was a journalist. The thing is, Mussolini was a really skilled journalist. And one thing I didn't realize when I started to research strongmen, how many of the most successful strongmen come from a background of either journalism or reality TV in Trump's case, or other kind of experience with the media. And this serves them well. And so Mussolini was an extremely skilled journalist. He was a sloganeer. He was a very good public speaker. He was good on camera. So he had all of the attributes. So he knew how to destroy the press because he was a journalist.
Is there anything about Mussolini in particular that you think is the most misunderstood or something that people have forgotten the most about him?
You know, of course, we think about Hitler because for many reasons, but because of his war against the Jews that ended up in the Holocaust. And Mussolini next to Hitler seems like the kind of, quote, nicer fascist. And he didn't go after the Jews for 16 years. He became dictator in 1925. He didn't go after the Italian Jews until 1938. And so even the kind of bias that there was at the time has endured, where you think, oh, Mussolini wasn't racist. But what Mussolini did is he went after, he had colonial violence. And in 1931, he committed what the Libyans consider to be genocide. He herded hundreds of thousands of people into concentration camps in the desert, forced marches, and he gassed, you know, he used gas on the colonial holdings of Italy. And because people don't really think about Italy as having a colonial empire, and Italy is always considered kind of a second-rate country and not taken seriously, all of this has been kind of lost to history, all of this violence. And again, Hitler is looking at what's happening with the concentration camps, and they happen to be in the desert, but they were concentration camps, and there were many penal colonies in Italy too. So his violence was extremely racist, but it was against Black people and Arabs. And so what mattered in terms of the Holocaust trajectory was Jews. So there was this mistaken idea that Mussolini, because he didn't go after the Jews, he didn't commit racist crimes. And that endured for decades and decades after 1945.
Did Italy still control Ethiopia when Mussolini was there? They did, right?
So Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. Yeah. And they had already Eritrea and Libya and Somalia and some other small holdings. But the Ethiopian war was actually more important. It was just as important as Munich in terms of breaking international laws. They used hundreds of tons of poison gas, and it was a testing of the international system, and Hitler was watching, because by then Hitler was in power. And the fact that they were allowed to get away with it set the tone for all of these other infractions up through Munich. But because the targets were, Black people in Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa, it wasn't taken seriously.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. And of course, the parallels to what's happening now, in terms of countries invading sovereign territory and nothing happening. I mean, that's what Putin's up to. I mean, he invaded Crimea and we didn't do anything. We just slapped some sanctions on and called it a day. And now we're paying the price for that,
And we should know better now, because we've had a century almost of, with Putin, you have to go after their money, because Putin is not just an autocracy, it's a kleptocracy. And the entire, he's like a parasite who preys on, society and sucks all the profits and raids businesses. And if you go after his money, which means also going after his Western enablers, all the banks, the law firms who help him hide his money, then you would get a different response for him. But nobody really wants to do that. There is progress on that front in general. Just right now, there's a new bipartisan congressional anti-kleptocracy Congress, a caucus. There's a lot going on, but nobody is standing up to Putin in particular.
Yeah, and we're gonna need to. That's gonna come to a head at some point. But I think it's interesting that some of the stuff that's happening now, I think people don't take it seriously, because most of the primary sources, the witnesses, people who lived through fascism in that first wave during the Second World War are either very old or dead. And so, as with Mussolini, we sort of forget what he did. People's perceptions of history are colored by movies they watch and stuff they read. And so Sean Hannity can go on TV and be like, well, Stalin wasn't that bad. He was our ally in the Second World War. How bad could he have been? Well, he was pretty bad, man. He was bad.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, there were two main reasons. One was I'm a historian by training, and I saw that as each autocrat took power today, they started to try and erase the memory of their crimes, of their country's crimes. They start rehabilitating, like stay with Putin. Putin started to rehabilitate Stalin, you know, cautiously at first. He put up some statues to him. And now then he passed laws where you're not allowed to talk about the Nazi-Soviet pact. He's extended the prison sentence of a historian who writes about the gulags. The extermination of the kulaks in the early 30s is now off limits. So I saw that there and elsewhere, the global right was intervening very strenuously to cover up their traces. And when you cover up violence, it creates the conditions for violence to happen again. So that was one major reason. It's also a reason that I had to do some, you know, difficult research. One of the other areas where people are trying to cover up crimes is the history of Pinochet in Chile. Mm-hmm. So there's a famous photo of a rally, the Proud Boys in 2020. One of them has a Confederate flag, so that's that history being rehabilitated. The other has a T-shirt, which is very popular among the global right. Pinochet did nothing wrong. And this is like whitewashing the history of his torture. So I wanted to really tell the story, and I went to great lengths to, you know, find testimonials and describe in difficult, you know, detail. It's not very fun reading, but I wanted to describe in detail what happened, what they did, so that nobody could say that he did nothing wrong. Or yeah. That it wasn't so bad, or it was an exaggeration.
They used the meme of the helicopter too, of the throwing the person out of the helicopter, yeah. Which is straight out of the Pinochet kind of playbook, right?
Yeah, and it's important to know about these things because they get recycled from strongman to strongman. So when Duterte in the Philippines, when he was campaigning, he distinguished himself as a strongman by talking about violence a lot. And one of the things, as he said, is that he had thrown somebody out of a helicopter when he was doing his military service, and he would do it again. And this is, if you know history, that's a direct reference to this kind of, you know, yeah. Pinochet, military junta, macho ethos. But you have to know about it to get how serious they are.
It's interesting that you talk about the rehabilitation, because then you think about it in terms of Trump and his supporters. I mean, One of the things he did, I mean, he did so many controversial things, but he put Andrew Jackson's portrait in the White House in sort of a place of honor. Andrew Jackson is, I don't know if you'd call him a dictator, but he certainly killed a lot of people. He was the president that was basically said, all right, no more treaties. We're just going to kill all the Indians now and take their land. I'm simplifying, but that's basically what happened. So by putting that picture up in the White House, he's sending a signal to anybody that's aware of this, you know, what he's doing. And I think the outrage about the critical race theory is the same thing. It's them not wanting to go back and look at the past and sins that have been committed, and to make it seem like everything was hunky dory and that we did nothing wrong. Pinochet did nothing wrong. Roger Stone did nothing wrong. Trump did nothing wrong. You know, all of the same things. So that's an interesting point.
And it's really very serious what's going on now. It was only a matter of time with book banning, but this kind of assault on the education system, trying to remove, it was very interesting because one, it was a state representative, I think in Pennsylvania, who was either Pennsylvania or Texas, who was advocating for hundreds of books to be banned. And he said that the criteria for him were books that would make students feel discomfort or yeah. guilt. And this is very important because when you're trying to have an authoritarian culture, you have to make people feel good about persecution, and you have to make them feel good about the nation. And so what you need to do is kind of squish their moral compass, like do things that extinguish their sense of morality. And so by he was exactly saying that we don't want them to have to read anything that's going to have pings of conscience, because then maybe they won't want to be racist like we're asking them to be. And so that's part of what's going on with critical race theory and the whole opposition to the 1619 project. It's part of the shift of a political culture toward autocracy. And whenever autocrats come to power, history comes under attack.
Yeah, it was in Texas, I believe, that guy that did Texas, that. Because I did a fake ad on my show here about it. But the this guy bans this thing in Texas, right? He's like, we're not going to, I don't think it passed, but that's what he was trying to do. We don't want this book. We don't want that book. Little does he know, kids don't read books. He has to get on TikTok and ban that and ban YouTube if he wants to get to the kids. Like banning absolutely. A Toni Morrison book is not going to, you know, it's not going to have the impact that maybe it would have 100 years ago when books were the only vehicle to learn anything about the outside world.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Here's a historical question for you. Now, if Mussolini's sort of the template for the strongman, and I think, what's his name? Ataturk, the guy in Turkey around that same period of time, maybe. Do you think it has to do with the timing of the end of the First World War and the decline of monarchies at that time? Because if you look back historically, there's always been obviously kings and queens and emperors and stuff like that, but most of them aren't really strong men. I mean, there's some example. Caligula was probably a strong man. I think Ivan the Terrible, after he went to did his little retreat where he had the boyars beg him to come back, came back as a strong man. You know, he invented the state secret police and had these guys on black horses terrorizing everybody. But most of the kings weren't really strong men in the way that Mussolini or Hitler or Putin are. So, I mean, do you think that it has something to do with that, or is it just coincidental?
No, there were lots of, obviously lots of tyrants in the past, and you did have monarchs who were extremely popular and had like a version of personality cult, but it was really World War One that was a mass trauma event that caused multiple empires to fall, that caused desensitization to violence among millions and millions of men and civilians. And there was this sense that old authorities were falling, and there was fear of male authority being compromised because so many men had been killed or were disabled. There were rumblings of anti-colonial activity. So there was a kind of set of circumstances that made it fruitful for new kinds of political systems to come into being. And so you had the Russian Revolution, and you had communism that comes out of the war, and you had fascism. But you really need, for the modern strongman, you need mass media and mass society. And that's what you didn't have before, because the personality cults of the 20th and 21st century depend on a certain configuration of media. And you didn't have that before, so it couldn't sustain them. And that's why they're so effective. Think about Trump tweeting over 100 times every day, and the immediacy. And one of the interesting things that writing the book is, in the propaganda chapter, I show that obviously some things have changed. The information technologies that these strongmen use are very different. Mussolini had newsreels, and Hitler mastered the radio, and so today social media. But some other things haven't changed at all. Like the rules of personality cults are exactly the same. You have to be a man of the people, and so that's the populist stuff. And then you have to be a superman. You have to be an everyman, and you have to be a superman. And so when you look at somebody like Trump, I started writing about him and was able to predict much of what he did, because he was completely familiar to me from studying Mussolini and studying, you know, fascism and the way that their propaganda worked.
Who is, I want to get to Trump later. I don't want to get too sidetracked, but which dictator or which strongman does he remind you the most of? Is it Mussolini, or is it somebody else, or?
He does remind me of Mussolini because he's a superb performer. And there's certain things that he does, like try to be all things to all people. So that's how he kind of will say one thing to evangelicals and another thing to, you know, mafiosi and housewives. And so all of these guys have these very eclectic constituencies because they have no morals and they'll tell each group what they want to hear. So, but in his bodily stuff, he also reminds me of Mussolini, his jutting out of his jaw and just a lot of the stuff he does, the slogans.
Yeah. The body type, the you know, alleged propensity for having a lot of pretty women around. That's a disturbing chapter in your book. We'll get to that. So let's go to, I want to talk about your book a little bit, which again is called Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. So the way that you have it set up for anybody who hasn't read it, who's listening, is it starts off sort of with, you talk about how they come to be, how they take power. And then at the end, you talk about how they fall. And in the middle, you talk about what you call the five tools of rule. So what I'd like to do is just, I'm going to throw out the five tools of rule. If you could just comment on each. The first one, I would say it's nationalism, really, or you said man of the people, right? Okay. So what's an example of that? Or what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So it's called a greater nation. And so it is about nationalism, but it's about how they use nationalism in a very specific way. So for example, on the one hand, they promise utopia. So everything's going to be great in the future, and they modernize and they deal with infrastructure. They build airports and, you know, Mussolini built all the sports stadiums. So they're Mr. Modern and Hitler with the Autobahn. But they also channel nostalgia. And this is really important because it's not making the nation great. It's also making it great again.
Right.
So and they all have this again. So Mussolini was like, I'm going to revive the Roman Empire. Today we have Erdogan in Turkey who's obsessed with reviving the Ottoman Empire. So that again is always there. So that's an example of stuff that these are these nationalist dynamics that actually haven't changed that much.
It's interesting too, because when you promise something to come again, you're really promising nothing. You're just kicking the can. You're promising some vision on the horizon that ultimately never happens. Every week is infrastructure week and nothing gets built, kind of thing. The second one is propaganda. So that we talked about that a little bit before, but that's just what was control of the media, right? And
it's control of the media. It's personality cults. It's also how in each age, media was used not only to spread the dogma, but also to create a climate of fear so that you had, well, and I don't have Stalin in my book. I don't have Mao and Castro because I wanted to do, except for Gaddafi, I have all right-wing strongmen. Because I wanted to show the lines between fascism and then the post-war military coups up to people like Trump and Bolsonaro. So you have this attempt to use propaganda to make violence acceptable. So the point of the book is to show how all these tools interact. So you need the propaganda to spread the violence. Right. You need the nationalism, making the nation great again, to help with the personality cult. So it all interlocks.
Yeah, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one is called virility. You could virility, which I think is interesting. And this isn't something that people think about that much. The part about Gaddafi is horrifying. It's one of the worst things. I read it before bed. It was one of the worst things I've ever read.
Oh, that's not a good time to read it.
It's awful.
I had to do... when I was, so that's a chapter about not just about how they use machismo as a tool of legitimacy, as a way of selling themselves. So you have Mussolini and Putin who have stripped their shirts off, and that goes with the propaganda. But the disturbing part is that it's all about controlling bodies. Yeah. And controlling women's bodies and controlling policing sexuality. So many of these guys, and Mussolini and Gaddafi in particular, It's as though Jeffrey Epstein, which will be familiar to your listeners, was the head of state. And we know how Jeffrey Epstein had fixers and scouts. Now we have Ghislaine Maxwell on trial. And so if you're the head of state, though, you use the secret police, you use all kinds of you have the whole bureaucracy devoted to your sex life and your, I call them pipelines of bodies. And the type of strongman personality, they tend to, they either get themselves into a dictatorial position so they can have these pipelines of bodies. So Gaddafi had scouts. When he would give a speech at a university, he would kind of find the most beautiful girls, and then they would, the next day, the secret police would come, and he had sex dungeons. He had sex slaves and sex captives. It's really horrible. Mussolini had thousands and thousands of women. He didn't keep them captive. He just had them summoned and then they would leave. But he had many, many long-term relationships and children. And it was a very, very complicated system. But what's interesting is in the 21st century, and it's late 20th century, 21st century, you have men like Berlusconi and Trump who go into, so they're businessmen, but they also go into sectors like modeling. So Trump had Trump Models. He owned Miss Universe. They go into areas of business that will allow them the pipeline of bodies. And so Berlusconi did the same thing because he had his TV shows. So that was a lure he could hold over women. And he also was very involved in beauty pageants. So that was very difficult to write, especially the parts about the sexual violence. But I wanted to, it's the first book actually to take masculinity and body politics seriously and place them up there with propaganda and corruption and violence as a tool of rule. Nobody else has done this before because political scientists don't tend to take masculinity that seriously.
But it is a serious thing. And you mentioned Epstein as an example. Harvey Weinstein is another example. Weinstein did have, he had apparatuses to get, you know, certainly the pipeline in, and he hired the Black Cube company to shut people up and did all these horrible things. When I was reading it, I thought of the guy from Cleveland that had the women locked up in the basement that wound up killing himself. Like, that's who I'm like, it's like if this guy was in charge of the country. Really, and, really sick people.
And one thing I found very interesting, because it is very bleak. I had to do a lot of yoga and they were trying to finish the Gaddafi section. If your listeners read it, you'll then know what I'm talking about. I had to, visit the wine store, go and do yoga, like anything to get through this, because it was very difficult, especially as a woman, to write. But what I found interesting since the release of the book is that most people don't want to discuss it, and most reviewers don't mention it. The whole sexual violence, because it's in, and one review said, "Well, it's a little unseemly. Like, I shouldn't have been talking about it."
Oh my God!
So that has gone largely not commented on, and I found that interesting. It's like people aren't really ready to hear that, even though we hear all the time about people who sexually assault people. We hear about Trump, but somehow the fact that this is actually part of strongman rule, I think many people weren't ready to have that integrated.
It's a very well-written chapter, and my God, I can't even imagine having to write it and research it and all that. So, I'm grateful to you for having done so. I've been trying to make the point and the connection between the attacks on Roe v. Wade and encroaching fascism, like that. It's not really that people are talking about, when does life begin and stuff like that. And not to minimize those conversations, those are theological conversations. The issue is not about that. The issue is that this is how fascists control people. I mean, there's nothing more authoritarian than the state forcing a woman to have a kid against her will and carry a pregnancy to term that she does not want. So I've been trying to you know, frame it that way, frame this as an issue, because also it's not, I think a lot of men read about abortion stuff and they just gloss over it and think, well, you know, I'm not going to have an abortion. Probably no one I'm with is going to have one, whatever. There's nothing I could do. But I feel like it's not just a woman's issue. I feel like this is a democracy issue. And by attacking it, what the Supreme Court has done and is doing is attacking democracy itself and paving and laying the foundation and the groundwork for whether it's Trump who runs in 24 or if it's DeSantis or somebody, you know, worse. Josh Hawley comes to mind. I think, you know, somebody like that who would, God knows what's going on in his
nightmare.
Yeah. So that's what I think anyway. I really do think it's like, guys, this isn't, you know, take it out of one frame and look at it in the big picture because they're trying to stomp on everybody's rights with this.
Yeah, it is a democracy issue, but to fully appreciate that, you have to know how important control of bodies and control of sexuality is to authoritarian regimes. So we need the history of that. We have ample evidence and history just in the States through evangelicals, and there's a long, you know, very tormented history just in what was supposed to be a democracy, but it's really part of the formula, as is in the 21st century, and it always has been. Now, attacking being anti-trans is part of the formula, but being anti-gay has been part of autocracy since the very beginning. And it's interesting when you do a global book like mine, because I have strong men who are from Europe, like the fascists and Putin, but I also have Gaddafi, who is from Libya, and I have Mobutu, who's from the Congo. And these were anti-colonial coups. These were anti-imperialists. And Gaddafi was a man of the left, but they were just as homophobic as their right-wing counterparts. So anti-gay is, and today anti-trans is like across the board. So policing sexuality and controlling bodies who don't fit your state definition of normality is part of the formula.
And of course, it's a big hypocrisy because these guys do whatever you know they want. The hypocrisy is sort of off the charts, and they can, you know, behave abhorrently while pretending to be these, paragons of virtue. And it goes back into the last two things in the book, really, corruption and violence, which I think are more obvious when people think about dictators, but nonetheless super important. So what do you mean exactly when you say corruption?
So I added the corruption chapter because it's almost like, yeah, of course they're all corrupt, but it was very important to unpack that. So it's not just financial corruption, and I talk about Putin's kleptocracy and the cronyism, but it's also, I wanted to explore the kind of moral corruption, because a lot of that chapter is about how strongmen set up the circumstances to corrupt people and to attract corrupt and corruptible people into their employ. So for Trump, I talked about how, like, there are all the violations of the Hatch Act and how you want to hire people who are already compromised. So throughout strongman history, many states have hired criminals, or they've pardoned. They use pardons to free up the worst elements of society for government service, because if somebody comes in and they're already corrupt, they are going to be able to, they won't object to what you're doing, and they will be able to corrupt others. So it's like a downward spiral. And so I talk about how the kind of government and civil servants culture that shifts when you have these guys come in to favor the corrupt and reward corruption. And so with Trump, this was very marked, how he purged, you know, the civil service of, he made it hostile work environments, especially in the Department of State, at the EPA, and a lot of people had to leave, and then sketchy people came in and they changed the application form for civil servants so that you didn't have to declare like some of your conflicts of interest. And that's the kind of thing, like bureaucracy might seem boring, but this is how you end up with like a lot of little Stephen Millers,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the corruption was not just about finances. It was also about behavior. How do you get people to accept all the unethical things? And then the final point is that most of these guys are criminals. And a large number of them, when they come into office, they're already criminals. They have criminal records or they're under investigation. And Trump is, I think we haven't quite grasped the magnitude of Trump's criminality. It's astonishing that he was president. He is a criminal in multiple ways. It's quite staggering.
Yeah, but it going back to his, you know, basically his childhood, he's second generation money launderer, all this kind of stuff. And also, you know, what, 4 dozen women now have been credibly accused him of rape or sexual assault, which nobody ever mentions. It's not, everyone just sort of glosses over that. And it's just this horrible thing. When you were talking about that, it reminded me of the guy, I forget his name, the sniper guy or the SEAL who went off and killed people that Trump pardoned and then brought to the White House and tried to boost up.
Yeah.
So he likes characters like that who now that guy's going to like Trump forever and be on the Trump team. Mm-hmm. And if Trump needs somebody killed, he could probably call him and be like, hey, buddy, I did a favor for you. And
look at Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yes.
So that's, I've been tweeting about that, but that could go, that's, if you've read the book, you have a frame to understand what's going on with Kyle Rittenhouse, who has now been lionized because he knows how to kill. He killed, you know, somebody. And those are the talents that are being rewarded right now in the GOP. So he's become a celebrity because he's a killer. And this is very disturbing, but this is when you have a political culture that is no longer in democracy, but is in autocracy, these are the kinds of people you want to have with you.
Yeah, it goes. And that's the last piece is the violence, which you know, we've had some violence in the country. We've had Charlottesville. Obviously, we've had the insurrection and things. And, you know, every other day, it seems like there's a shooting somewhere. But in terms of sustained, you know, riot type civil war-esque violence, we've been, I think, very fortunate that has not happened yet. Because when you consider all of the brainwashing and the disinformation campaigns and the Fox News and everything else, and all of the guns that are out there and ammo and all this kind of stuff, and the ease with which these people can hook up on Facebook or, you know, however they do it now, it's really a powder keg, I think, and it's really terrifying.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, there are people who study civil wars who think we have all the conditions in place. And there's been, because of the pandemic has accelerated everything, as well as Trump radicalizing people. Mm-hmm. And the key is the violence chapter is not only shows that over 100 years, how what has stayed the same, in terms of mass imprisonments and different types of concentration camps, but also what has changed in our age of the smartphone and citizen journalism. You don't have quite as much open massacres on a very large scale.
Yeah.
They still go on, but it's harder to pull it off. So you have like what the Chinese have done, where you have a region and you seal it off. And you do it there, and that's of course because anti-Muslim. You target one population, but a lot of the chapter on violence also looks at how these people use propaganda to get people to see violence in a different way, and that's one of the scariest things that Trump did, is that from the very beginning of his campaign, and I have a huge file with a list of all the times he had rallies starting in 2015, where he said, oh, we used to be able to bash people's heads in, you know, we used to be able to punch people. So he came out swinging. He mm-hmm. came out very strongly advocating violence, physical violence. And so we've had 5 years of that now, 6 years actually. And so he has successfully convinced millions of Americans that violence is an acceptable way of doing politics. And that's why there's that poll, which people comment along a lot on right now, that showed that like something like 40% of Republicans felt that violence might be necessary to restore Trump to power. And that is a huge, we will look back and Trump is one of the most skilled propagandists of our times. He's like a 21st century Goebbels. He's extremely skilled. And he spent a huge amount of his time, he invested a huge amount of his time in propagandizing. That's what he did. That was his main thing he did besides trying to make money for himself off of the White House. And he's had a huge success with not just with the big lie, but with violence is now something that's patriotic. And that's where we're now going to live with the effects of that.
I want to talk more about Trump. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ruth Ben-Ghiat. Okay, we're back with Ruth Ben-Ghiat. I want to talk about Trump now. I know we've been talking about him a little bit. I get the appeal. Now, some of the strongmen, I think, when they come into power, they do certain things that they can point at that are kind of accomplishments, right? When Gaddafi took over, he nationalized the state oil company, renegotiated the lease with British Petroleum, had all of this money, which he used to provide healthcare and education. That's exactly what you should do. Then he went totally crazy and bonkers and did all these evil things, but he had that initial thing that he did that people could be like, oh, maybe he's not so bad. Hitler, at the ruins of the First World War, was able to get the military back, and Mussolini famously made the trains run on time, or maybe he didn't, but that's what it was said. So the thing I don't get about Trump is he didn't do anything. He didn't deliver anything, did he? Or is this not no longer necessary? Am I reading it wrong? What do you think?
Well, I don't see, those guys didn't deliver anything either, really. I mean, Gaddafi's a bit of an exception. He wasn't, because he was an anti, he was a man of the left, and he was an anti-colonial ruler, and he wanted to kind of save his people from the degradation of imperialism. So, but Hitler built some, he restored the prestige of the military, and he built lots of roads and stuff, but you can't, that's the point of the book, is that you can't separate those things from the violence and from the propaganda and from the destruction. And ultimately, these are extremely destructive realms. And these leaders don't have a sense of public welfare. It's all about them. It's all about protecting them getting rich. You know, Hitler and Trump both said, oh, I don't take a salary because I'm all about sacrificing myself for the nation. But then they made money in many, many other ways. And, you know, when we think about Mussolini, the trains run on time. Well, nobody knew if they run on time or not, because there were no strikes allowed. There was no free press. You couldn't complain about anything, or you were imprisoned or killed. So I see them as extremely destructive individuals. And the more you understand how they govern, I did not expect Trump to be so similar in his temperament. But unfortunately for America, he had pretty much a very similar personality to a lot of these guys. Now, the outcome is different today. We don't have as many one-party states today. We don't have as many genocides. You know, the outcomes are different, but the instincts to surround yourself with family members and cronies and flatterers, to hire and fire people, all of that is to create a kind of buffer around you so you can steal and be a thief. All of that is the same. So the key is that they're not interested in public welfare. They have no interest in governance in a traditional sense. They're interested in amassing absolute power and profiting off of, you know, governance. And
I didn't mean to suggest that they did anything good. I meant that they were using it, you know, as propaganda, you know, as something like, hey, we did this one thing. Look at what we did. Just to be clear, I'm not saying great job. Okay.
The thing is that people didn't understand about Trump is that he had no interest in governing. His aims were different and his priorities were different than any other president, Republican or Democrat in the past, because his aims were he's a money launderer, he's a criminal. And his aims were to make money off of the White House. And yes. So he had no interest in the business of being president. So that's why he spent one out of every 3 days until COVID hit, one out of every 3 days visiting a Trump property. And so people would say, oh, he's golfing again, he's so lazy. He's not lazy. He's doing what he wants to be doing, which is making money off of the presidency. So it's very interesting. One third of his time was spent visiting his own businesses in a very, you know, like bald-faced manner. And then the other thing he was interested in was indoctrinating people and creating a cult of personality and loyalty around himself so that he could be untouchable. So that no matter what he did, people would still love him. They would still believe in him. And he could get away with it, whatever crimes he was committing. And he successfully imposed on the GOP, he turned it into kind of an authoritarian party. He imposed it. He imposed a party discipline that you see only in authoritarian states. And that is why when Republicans who deviate from the party line had death threats. So it's not just Democrats who have death threats, it's Republicans. So during the second impeachment trial, any Republican who voted to impeach Trump had to buy body armor. So these are transformations that are authoritarian in nature. And that was the other thing that he did. So making money, creating personality cult, and making himself untouchable, and imposing an authoritarian control on the party. Those were his goals, not ministering to the population in a pandemic. He didn't care about any of that. When the pandemic first came in March 2020, I did an interview with HuffPost, and I said something that got people upset because they weren't ready to hear it. And I said that Trump doesn't care if you live or die. Just couldn't care less if there was mass death, because he doesn't care about Americans. He only cares about himself.
Well, you are absolutely 100% correct. Now, you said before you were, even presumably during the campaign, you were watching him thinking, oh my God, this is like Mussolini 2.0 here. The first press conference that Sean Spicer, who was the first press secretary, had after Trump was sworn in, was when he went up there and talked about the inauguration, the size of the crowd at the inauguration, which everybody who had watched it on TV knew was smaller than Obama's. And yet Spicer insisted that that was not the case. And even he seemed like, you know, he knew he was lying. But what were your thoughts at that time? And what are your thoughts about that now? Because that strikes me as a really important tone-setting moment for the entire administration that was to come.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's easy for us to forget these things. And this was a breach of presidential custom that was one of the first signs after he got into office that he was not going to be a normal president of either party, that his priorities, again, were becoming known as the best president ever, having a personality cult. So he has to have, you know, not only had to be much better than Obama, he had to have, he was going to be lying and struck to those around him to lie. And so the Spicer thing, what I thought at the time was Spicer was being corrupted in public. Mm-hmm. The corruption of Spicer was being demonstrated in public. And that's how they get you. Because after that, I mean, Spicer was kind of in, right? That the Godfather quote, you know, I try and get out and they keep drawing me back in. Once you do that publicly, he's got you. And that's what he did to many, many people. And so this was the first instance of that.
Yeah. Okay, I know you've got to go. So I got two more questions and then I will release you. I think about Orban, Viktor Orban, who had some ties to Trump, and now what's happening with Tucker Carlson, basically going to Hungary, doing the show from there, just trumpeting this guy who's awful and an autocrat for sure. What happens to these propaganda people historically in these regimes? I know that we don't have the TV, it's not exactly analogous, but is there hope that people like Tucker and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and these other purveyors of just shit, awful fascist propaganda are going to get what's coming to them? What do you think is going to happen?
It's hard to think that they'll get what's coming to them because Fox acts like a state media, but it is independent and it's Murdoch. And Murdoch he does what he wants to do. And also, unfortunately, you know, Fox it's very successful, and Tucker Carlson's show is one of the most watched shows in all of America. So there's been a lot of discussion about how they take the cue from their base, and as the base has become more radicalized, they have become more radicalized too. So it's a huge problem. And I've written a couple of pieces for my newsletter, Lucid, about the GOP's fetish of Hungary and Tucker Carlson going there and Mike Pence going there and talking about how he hopes that abortion rights will be taken away soon. And the reason they all glom onto Hungary is, you know, Putin is, many of them are heavily invested in Russia, and there's all of those ties that we know about. But Putin can also be a little toxic, and he's a little extreme. People fall out of windows. He invades places. Hungary has the appearance of moderation. It's not, in reality, it's not at all. The guy ruled by decree in 2020. There's not much freedom at all. But you don't hear as much about violence. You don't hear about people being poisoned. And so it seems to be a quote, more acceptable autocratic model. And that's one reason that they think it's going to be like, it looks more respectable. Like, I don't think Mike Pence would go and stand next to Putin. But he didn't have any problem, or Tucker or others, standing next to Orban.
Even though Orban, you know, if you believe Mogilevich's right-hand man who testified, is a bag man for Mogilevich, yes. You know, one of the most powerful Russian mobsters or international organized criminals alive. Yes. That's who Orban is.
And Orban is, he's got the son-in-law, you know, they've all got this same corruption schemes, and the EU has really appeased him over and over again. He should be kicked out of the EU. He shouldn't have EU funding anymore, but he does. So when we talk about modern autocrats, we have to talk about their Western enablers. And unless that changes, they don't have much incentive to become more moderate.
Yep. Okay, so we are recording this on December 29th. It's not going to run until 2022 in January, so lots of things can happen between now and then. But it feels like I'm so up and down with the future. There are days when I feel like we are so fucked that it's just all hope is lost, and I don't know how we can possibly dig out of this. And then there's other days when I'm like, no, enough change will be made. We have enough people in power. It's not going to happen where it's going to be, they're just going to go arrest everybody, but maybe enough things will happen that democracy will be saved. And I go back and forth. Where are you right now in this thing? Should we be afraid? Is there cause for hope? How are you feeling?
2022 is going to be absolutely pivotal. I feel many, many bad things could happen. Many people have worked very hard to put us in a situation for bad things to happen. But I also think that we haven't heard the last of all of the energies that led to Black Lives Matter protests, it's very important to remember two things. One, Black Lives Matter protests were multi-generational, multiracial. They involved between 20 and 26 million people across the country. And it was the biggest social protest movement in history, in American history. Two, it translated directly into getting rid of Trump. We voted him out and there was record voter turnout for Biden. And so we just did this recently. Yeah. And we should not forget this. That said, there were 80 million people who didn't vote. And it's going to be very, very important to counteract and compensate for all the voter suppression, that those people be registered. So if people want to do something, the best thing to do, and all the democracy experts say this, is to get involved with voter registration, with voting rights, because it's the GOP is trying to make your vote null and void, but there still will be elections. There are always elections in Hungary, except they fix them, but they hold them. So that's important to do. I think that if the GOP wins if they get control of the House and the Senate, all kinds of autocratic scenarios could unfold, but we'll just have to see.
Okay. I do feel kind of hopeful. I'm going to say I do. You're right about the BLM stuff. And I don't know. I just feel like he's such an asshole. Like most people don't want to be governed by assholes. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. There's a lot of assholes that have come out of the woodwork, but at the end of the day, I don't know. I don't know how many people who are competent to make this stuff happen are going to be eager for it. I hope. That's all we can do. Okay. Your book is called Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. And your Substack, which is excellent, is called Lucid. I encourage everybody to buy and read the book. Sign up for the newsletter, which is wonderful. And you do these Q&As at Lucid too, right? Where people can, how does that work? Is that on Zoom? How does that work?
Yeah, you register. We were hacked and by far-right extremists. And I just published a piece in New York Daily News about the experience of being hacked by these homophobe and racists, but it only made us stronger. So we now have a lot of other security protocols in place, but you register and they're fantastic. It's an hour Q&A and we've been doing it every week for 8 months. And so there's a real solidarity. So it's a kind of supportive safe space to ask all kinds of questions. And it's a real group has formed. It's great. I think everybody really enjoys it. Even though I will say scary things from time to time, it's a space where many people, if there's activists, there's lawyers, there's all kinds of people who attend them. And many people have found each other through these weekly Q&As.
All right, so check it out. It's on Lucid. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate having
you. Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.